When you get the Planet Fitness Black Card, you can bring a friend anytime you work out. And now through March 13th, get your first month free when you join. You heard that right. Conquer the stair climber with your partner in climb. Enjoy a post-workout recovery session in the hydro massage. And do it all again with access to any of our 2,700 convenient locations. So, you coming? Get your first month free and all the perks with the PF Black Card for just $1 down, $24.99 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends March 13th. See club for details.
Erica Bozeman, a.k.a. Boze, is a Twitch streamer and YouTube creator who covers true crime stories and the psychology behind them. We chat about how to spot the subtle signs of various personality disorders and potential for future criminal behavior, how childhood experiences shape our tendency to attract narcissists and other dangerous personalities into our lives, and our own personal experiences in escaping the influence of those dangerous people.
You had mentioned something before about like dangerous traits that possibly lead to violence. Mm-hmm. Like, do you recognize traits in men that like you think like, oh, this person is potentially violent? Like, what's a red flag to you?
I think it's far fewer than women notice for sure. I think women are hyper attuned to potentially violent men, generally speaking. But the only time where I do is it's so obvious. It's aggression, cursing, short-temperedness. Like, it's the ones that are just in your face, that person is ready to hit something, that I notice. I do not fear violence in that way from people.
Oh, yeah. This is why you haven't prepared for how...
This is why I haven't prepared for serial killer stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so tell me, what are you looking for and how are you preparing for your serial killer
Why is that funny to you? This is very real, Charlie.
Yeah, I'm curious.
Okay, so on my stream, we watched the show a lot called I Survived, and it's pretty grim, but, you know, it's people telling, survivors telling their stories of how they, you know, survived a near death or were almost murdered. And the number one way that people survive a murder or an attempted murder is playing dead. It is number one for sure. Like, yeah, a lot, like, because it's interesting. The human body can sustain a lot. Okay, like you would think. Okay, sorry, I'm getting all grim here, but I talk about true crime all day.
Yeah, yeah.
You might think like if you were stabbed 20 times, like you're probably gonna die. Most likely, you're not gonna die, especially if they were like frenzied stabbings or they were not in major areas. But also, what I mean by like major areas are like somebody could stab you like arms, face, like Whoa. Neck, like everything. They could do it 20, 30 times, and like you will live.
Wow.
Like, you got to be like. A lot has to happen. So what happens is a lot of times if there is like a, if it's not a crime of passion. Okay. All right. I'm going to explain some forensic stuff to you, Charlie.
Break it down.
But I know we were like talking all psych, but like, hold on, forensic time. So if, or actually this is a little psychology too. So if somebody were to find a person that had 70 stab wounds, okay. And they were all upper body, like neck, face, something like that. What does that say to you? Just off firsthand.
They're trying to destroy them. They're trying to delete.
Yes. They, them. Like the face is, yeah, I yeah. hate you. I hate yeah. you. I hate you. I never want to see you again.
Yeah, yeah.
So we now know this is not a random burglar. Mm-hmm. This is like a crime of passion. Yeah. Or this person knew them, right?
Uh-huh.
So now we've already, just by looking at the forensics, we've already zeroed in on a profile of who it may be.
Interesting.
Right? Not going to the crime of passion and the more intimate one, but let's say it's like a random burglar, right? So they're not going to stab you 20 times. They're not going to stab you 50 times because they just are like, hey, I want you to die so I can like take this shit or whatever. Yeah. They're probably going to shoot you once, maybe shoot you twice or stab you like 3 or 4 times. Mm-hmm. Like, bro, honestly, most people will survive a non-majorly wounding like couple of stab wounds or so. But then after that, if people generally play dead, the attacker doesn't really come, like they think like, oh, you're dead or you're gonna die, and they'll kind of like, you know, go away. That's only for a random one.
That's if you're okay. So let's in terms of survival prior to the person has stabbed you or shot you, is there, I know the one that I've heard is like never go to a second location.
Oh,
that sort of
stuff. That's like, you mean for like dates? Like
for if a, what I've heard, and I don't know if it's true, if your research shows this, but like if a man, if you're a woman and a man is like getting into the car.
Oh.
And you're like in a somewhat area and there's people down the road. It is like, you are better off taking your chances right there in the semi-public place before the second location. Because once you're in a second location, then it's much more grim.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason why the get in the car, let's go here works is because, you know, Ted Bundy did this. He would like bump into women and then target the ones that apologized to him first. Because so just like,
oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. And so just like with the car, get in the car, let's go here. If the woman were to get in that car, she is trusting this person more than she trusts herself.
Uh-huh.
And your self-doubt has to be on the floor to trust this random guy.
Yeah. If I give him what he wants, then I will
stop.
Be okay.
Then I'll be okay.
Then he'll stop.
Yeah. And like, and it's taking advantage of vulnerable people that are just indoctrinated with self-doubt.
And the fawn response is he's looking for, I bump into you, how do you deal with conflict? And if the answer is I apologize and fawn rather than retreat from you or curse at you or, you know, any of these other things, that's an interesting one. I think we all have all of them. What I've been uncovering in my life is the when and where I have this fawn response, which is it's not in Ted Bundy situations or anything like that. But I see this pattern of believing if I'm nice, you won't hurt me.
I have that one too. Yeah. And let me tell you right now, Charlie,
that's fawn.
The dumbest fucking shit ever. Because bro, the nicer you are, the more people will steamroll you. I'm in my bitch era. Okay. I'm there.
Well, all of them, all fight, flight, freeze, and fawn when they're coming from a trauma response are just not ideal to the circumstance, which you'd like to be present to whatever's happening. But I notice it in my business. Like when I'm firing people, I feel there's a fawn response where I like don't want to fire them and I feel sad and scared that they're going to be upset or retaliate or then go into the business and they're going to destroy everything. And so I'll try to make it last for another month or two, even though I'm dissatisfied with the work, and convince myself that other work isn't that bad. So the reason that I think like the killer stuff is interesting is because all the patterns that are displayed by the victims and the killers are things that I experience in smaller degrees in my very normal life.
And that's why true crime is interesting to some people. Some people see it as just like, oh, you guys are listening to this horrible murder. I did this show called Sinister each week. And it's on Fridays on my YouTube channel. But I do this show Sinister each week. And anybody that watches that show knows they're 45 minutes to an hour. I might talk about the murder for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. The whole show is about childhood or situations of like how we got to this point, you know? That's what I'm interested in. Like, some people really think true crime is just like actually just talking about the most brutal fucking things ever. Even though it also depends like with the ethics of like a true crime creator, but
tell me about the childhood. So is it the profile of the murderer in these cases or that you're often digging into? I know a little bit about this, but tell me what you see as common.
Let's see. What do I see that's common?
I can share one right off the bat that
give me one.
I believe if it's like a male serial killer, like Charles Manson, that the mother is often someone who he witnesses experiencing sexual violence. So like men hurting the mother, the mother's a prostitute, the mother's a something, he's got an abusive stepfather. Like that's it. Like watching men hurt women at a young age when it's your mother tends to create a tremendous amount of rage. And then that explodes.
You want a true crime story?
Yeah, please.
I'll try to make it under 6 minutes. But I'm just going to like ramble for a minute, but I think you'll like this one.
Okay.
Okay. So there's this kid. His name was James Marlowe. This was like in the 70s or the 80s. And when you're born into the world, the standards are set for you by your parents. Normalizations are set for you by your parents. So by all accounts, whatever James Marlowe's parents did would be the box that he starts in, right? So he was raised by a single mother who was also a prostitute.
Yeah, so common, so common.
And also, she was beautiful. I think this is something that people don't talk about enough because it's weird, but when a guy has a really attractive mom, it does something.
Huh.
I don't, because once again, like I'm not a guy. So there's certain things where my brain just can't go there. But I've noticed this, just men that have really pretty moms, they develop some kind of trait But anywho, so James Marlowe's mother, single mother, prostitute, also hardcore drug addict. I mean, he was raised by a beautiful, lawless woman. Mm-hmm. And so this is where his box starts. And I mean, the world is nothing like the world that this mother is about to show him, you know? So that's already fucked. But James has a sister too, a younger sister, and the mom is so into drugs and, you know, whatever. She's constantly having dudes over at the house, fucking them in the house. And then also stealing money from the clients in front of James, like telling James, like, this is just the way the world works. Mm-hmm. You know, he was hearing his mom like have sex on a regular basis. And then sometimes she would just abandon him for these drug binges. But no matter what, James always wanted his mother. Like, all he wanted was for her to come back. And even later in like court documents, his sister noted, like, I knew mom was crazy, that she was a bitch, but James loved his mother like so dearly. Mm. So eventually she leaves for like a year and he goes to stay with his dad for the first time. And for some reason, his dad hates men. This is another really weird, rare trope. Sometimes there's mothers that hate women and then they have daughters and then they treat them like shit and they put their sons on a pedestal. But even rarer, but very real, are men that don't trust other men that have sons. Mm. So when James goes to stay with his dad, he's wildly abused. His dad would literally put him in a cabinet, put a fucking spoon through the cabinet and just make James sit there, thus creating this freeze response that he would have later in life because he would spend hours under this fucking cabinet.
Wow.
So anyways, James always just wants his mommy, and eventually mom comes back and he's 13 years old and he comes back and he's living with his mom and his sister and he's just so happy. Like, this is the interesting thing about James. No matter how horrible his mom was, he didn't have a barometer and he just wanted her love. And so, you know, when he's 13, he's at home one day and she's like, hey, I think you're old enough. And she shoots him up with heroin and he tries heroin for the
early
first time.
Early drug use is another one. Yeah.
Yep. And then she begins a relationship with him. She molested him, but they were having sex for, and I, like, I have to say, yes, this is rape, but I'm saying like she had groomed him into this sexual relationship. So he's literally like sleeping with his mom from 13 to 18 or 19. Wow. And then he gets, is this interesting to you so far?
I mean, it's wild.
Okay.
It's wild. This is like fringe humanity stuff, but go ahead.
No, yeah. There's a lot of cases like this. I'm just very familiar with this one. So then James this was also interesting. When James was 18, he eventually moves out and he gets married to this woman. Marriage only lasts 2 or 3 months, gets divorced, and then he gets married again. And then he gets married again. He had 6 different marriages before he was even 24 years old.
Wow.
That's how much this woman fucked him up, you know? Mm-hmm. And then when he was in his mid-20s, his mom abruptly died in a house fire. She was smoking a cigarette and burned the whole house down and she died. And this is when James started killing people.
Holy cow.
Because it was like all of that rage that was sitting in him from everything that his mother did as he explored the world and started to learn mm-hmm. that what happened to him was wrong, which we all go through actually, you know, when he started to realize this, I'm sure there was a rage that was building, but he never got to release it because his mother died. And after that, he started abducting and killing women with his girlfriend.
Wow. I'm sure there are many different prototypes, but I do, again, the small personal version is the unexpressible rage at the mother, I think, is a very, very common thing for men. And this is the to 100 in infinity example, but it is the smaller version of that. It's the smothering. It's the too closeness of the mother and or the not close enoughness that is
I'm smothering you because I love you.
Yes, yes. I'm doing this for you. And
this
it is
love.
Exactly. The lack of attuned love that becomes smothering, that when you're little, I experience this and I think some men do, at least in my household, like rage at my dad existed. Like we would go at it and fight and sometimes I got spanked and that's not ideal. But the anger that I had for him was available to me. I could find it. I was not angry in that way with my mom. And it's only as I got later that I started to do psychedelics and therapy and that sorts of things that I could feel for the first time the anger of like the passive aggressive anger, the like, oh, you're hurting me by not calling me, the You're hurting me by not
tripping.
The guilt tripping, the all of these sorts of things that I could start to feel anger about that sort of stuff.
Frustrates me about that.
Go ahead.
Just say really quick.
Yeah, yeah.
It is so easy to not guilt trip people. Mm. It is so fucking easy. Like I've had lots of conversations with you. I've never felt a moment where I felt guilt tripped by you. I would hope vice versa, you know? But like, it's so strange to me when I have conversations with people where I am constantly being guilt tripped because I have experienced how easy it is to not guilt trip people. Yeah. So like, how is this happening?
Well, I think my limited understanding is that one, particularly men and women can do it, but it's a form of trying to get your needs met that is more common as a passive strategy. And it's more common in women who are not encouraged to directly go for what they want.
Yeah.
So my mom grew up in a household with 9 brothers and sisters. There was not enough attention or time or stuff to go around. And asserting yourself directly to try to get it, she was number 7 of 10, was like not an option.
Right.
You know? So the you're hurting me, I'm sad, you need, like we go, and the family migrated at any moment to the biggest crisis that was occurring. So if somebody was just regular sad, but somebody was sick or somebody got, you know, like you had to go to the greatest need. So the way of getting your needs met became hurting the most. And so then you learn not just to be hurt, but to be hurt at people, right?
Yeah.
And so then instead of just being like, oh man, I'm sad that you can't come, which can have like a, oh, thank you. I feel loved in that.
Yeah,
I'm
like, missed.
It's like, oh, you're not going to come? Oh, no. Like, there's this.
This is going to affect me if you don't do this.
There's this pulling nature of it. Yeah. And so just like I've learned, just like you can be angry at someone, you can be sad at someone. And so I'm learning today how to just be angry and how to just be sad without pointing it at a person and using it as a tool to get them to give me what I want.
Yes, 100%.
Them.
And you know what? I like that you said that. One of my favorite things that I've learned in the past year is sitting in my anger and sitting in my anxiety. I was taught to swallow my anger. I'm a woman. I can't be angry. Of course I'm going to be angry at stuff. Bad shit happens to people all the time, you know? It is nonsensical for me to swallow my anger at every turn, right? Mm-hmm. Only in the past year have I learned that anger always passes. Always. But, you know, bottling up emotions and stress, it actually doesn't always pass. But anger is incredibly fleeting. Like, have you ever been mad for 3 days straight?
Only when I don't feel it. Yeah, only when I seethe.
Yeah,
when it's seething
last weeks, months, years. Anger is a small fraction of time. And it's actually really kind of beautiful when you feel the anger and let it exist.
Yeah.
And then let it, you know, move on. I love sitting in my anger now. I also love sitting in my anxiety now. I mean, I know it sounds corny, but I think it's really beautiful now because I couldn't do that before. And I see how fruitful the other side is.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is, you're reminding me, I'm learning about my own fawn response. Yeah. And I think it's directly connected to what we're talking about with anger, which is I fawn because I'm disconnected from my anger, which would help me draw a boundary. And I fawn oftentimes in situations that remind me of my mom. Which is somebody loves me. They work at the big company. They're trying hard. They want to be there. You know, they just want to, it's not working out, but it's like, why can't, or they've invited me somewhere and they're trying to see me, but I don't really want to go to, you know, like that's where my fawn response is strongest. And it's because I am not feeling anger because in the moments when I did, and I would feel angry at my mom as she, you know, was coming toward me trying to get love or give love or anything, whatever happened just did not feel good. And so I'm learning, okay, when I, you know, I receive all the time invitations to go to dinner, invitations to go here, and I don't want to go. Weirdly enough, if I feel the anger of my own violation of my boundaries, is I'm like, well, I could fit it in between 6 and 7 and I could, if I drove there, I could do it. That helps me just be way more comfortable saying no. Are you comfortable with no, by the way?
Yeah.
I'm learning to be better with no's.
Yeah, I think I have a lot of social anxiety. Are you socially anxious at all?
I suppose, you know, I've never processed it like that. I just went like, I'll just learn this, you know, and then I don't have to feel this.
I've only recently learned I'm extremely socially anxious. And this is interesting because you're talking about the fawn response, which, I mean, this is all about people. I thought that social anxiety was like having stage fright or being afraid to be out in public or like being kind of agoraphobic. But I've learned social anxiety is really like, okay, how am I going to be perceived? Do then I feel I have like being perceived anxiety. This day? And did every interaction go perfectly? Yeah, did it go? Or, and is it going to go perfectly? And what? And like, oh my God, they hated me. And oh my God, I did this wrong. And I didn't smile here. I didn't introduce this person, or I didn't, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I've learned that social anxiety, it's not just the party itself. It's the stress that I feel deciding if I'm going to go to the party. And then the reflection afterwards when I think about how much of a piece of shit I am. So
oh, interesting. Because that's how Charisma on Command got built. No one was willing to review it as intensely as me and my co-founder Ben were. Like no one would sit there and dissect an hour conversation or an hour interaction for the next 3 hours and be like, well, if we've done this and we've done that. If that's social anxiety, then
it is.
I'm the president.
Yeah, it really is. But see, you probably didn't think of social anxiety as that before. And, you know, I've also realized too, you know, I was taking those introvert, extrovert quizzes for like years. And I thought, oh, I'm an introvert. Like, no, I'm a fucking extrovert with social anxiety. And it can be a little like lonely at times because your social anxiety will keep you from going to those things that build community and also help you push past the want for perfection. Like, you know, I know you're a perfectionist too, Charlie.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, you can't be perfect in social interactions. So being a perfectionist that is also socially anxious and extroverted is like really a disgusting puzzle. If you are also dealing with this, you're in pain. We're in pain.
I didn't know I was a perfectionist until just a few weeks ago.
I told you were a perfectionist like a few months ago.
Yeah. I am. What was hard about it?
I'm a woman.
Well, because like I'll have stains. I'll have stains on my shirt, and I'll do things poorly, and I'll. There's areas of my life that are just like sub average for sure.
Oh, for sure.
But what it's this social thing where I will pour over if I was kind enough or thoughtful enough or charismatic enough for ages and ages over decades, where I realize. And there's a part of my consciousness that I'm learning to let sit at while I'm talking, I'm thinking about how I'm talking. You know, there's that very active commentary voice in my head of like, oh, that was stupid. That was like, I didn't know that was perfectionist. I thought that was like my helpful friend, like, you know, helping me
to little buddy, but your little buddy's little mean sometimes, aren't they? They make you have a bad day.
He's
sometimes.
Like, well, yes. And it's the,
and you fawned that little voice, huh?
Yes. And you know, that's an interesting, yeah. And it was, it's not perfectionist. He's just pointing out the things that could be better. And there's value to that. It helps me make good stuff. But yeah, there's brutality.
Oh, you also have a trait of rationalizing a thing that's hurting you.
Oh, yeah. I haven't. And so you're right. There's a lot of, and I guess women too, but men perhaps in particular, I don't need to gender everything, but the living in your head when you're hurt deeply, like that's what you do as a guy. You just fucking cut off from the hurt. And then you go, well, I don't have a really good reason to be hurt. And it didn't hurt that bad. And like, you know, it's okay. And I think women probably cut off from anger. Like you said, well, like what she said wasn't that mean. And like, I can't be angry about that. So there's, hurt is a tough one to feel. Sadness, hurt.
Yeah. Well, it's also a hit to the ego because it's a reminder that you are human and you can be hurt and you can be sad and, you know, you can be not perfect. To me, I was raised, the way I was raised, I always had to be happy. Otherwise, it made people uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So when I'm sad, I'm being imperfect. And like, it's fucking hard, you know? Or when I'm angry, I'm being imperfect. Like, dude, when I was growing up, I had to go to charm school, okay? Like,
did you really?
Yeah, I did.
Wow, how old?
I don't remember exact age, but I was very young, like 5, 6, 7.
Oh, wow. That's young.
Oh yeah.
To be a charming 5-year-old.
Oh, Charlie, my life story will make you throw up.
Do you want to do it?
No. I looked at the camera. I was like, no. Okay. No. But yeah, no,
it's safe to say that there was a performance pressure at a very, very young age.
There was no expectation to perform. It was just be happy. Otherwise, and that's the thing, because you know what? I feel like it's the same for you. Be happy, otherwise blank.
Yeah, yeah.
What is the blank? Well, but it's terrifying, and maybe it's the uncertainty that's so terrifying. I hate uncertainty.
Yeah. Well, I know what it was for me. It was it wasn't in my case malicious or anything like that, but I'll just take my mom because I've been picking on her, and I love her. If my mom is just saying, like, you can only be as happy as the kid who's the most sad, which sounds like love, but is actually really difficult because it means if I'm sad, I'm hurting my mom.
Yes, I have one of those. I have one of those exact ones. You know,
and
my
she
mom would
still
say to
says
me,
it to this day, and it's like I don't think she realizes how limiting
yeah.
that is in terms of what I'm ever going to show up and bring to you. And there you go. You're welcome, mom. Now you know,
dude. But- my oh, dude, I got one for mine too. All right, bitch. my mom would say, I'm only happy if you're happy.
Yeah, which is
which
like,
is wrapped up in love and it feels like love. Mm-hmm. And oh my God, she loves me so much that she wants me to be happy.
Yeah.
But now I have to be happy. Otherwise my mom is sad yes. or else.
Yeah. So the thing that has been weirdly is been to be able to be hurt and sad while people will acknowledge it, offer help, but not insist. And just like, okay, well, I'll be okay. And you can just be lousy. It's like, what a fucking relief to have... to like share that I'm not feeling well, have someone respond compassionately. I'm not yet ready to come out of my shell. They're like, I love you. I'm here, you know? And, yeah. and I'm going to go joyfully exist.
Yeah.
And to just be able to sit here and be like, oh my God, the world can move in a beautiful way. And
yes.
I don't have to feed the joy of the world.
Yes.
Is, oh, and I remember the first time I experienced this, I was like taking deep breaths.
Somebody while taking somebody, the pressure off of
while
you.
While somebody was just happy while I was miserable and I told them and they're like, well, thank you. And I'm here for you. And I'm going to go, this was in a psychedelic journey. It was my girlfriend. She's like, I'm going to go dance now. I was like, oh, this feels so nice.
And you know what else? It's somebody trusting you that you can handle your bad emotions.
Yes.
Which is a little empowering for people that, especially when they were raised to believe that they had to lean on some other thing. But this person is saying to you, I'm not going to put pressure on you to get better right now. Uh-huh. I also trust that you can handle this on your own. And I also trust that if you need me, you'll let me know. And like, that trust is really important.
Totally. Well, this is the thing that I took it personally. You make everything about you as a child naturally, right? The story you tell yourself of why your parents got divorced or don't fight or everything is because of me. You know, it's because I was a bad boy or whatever. And if parents reinforce that, it's just double. So that, I didn't get that level of trust that I could do it or it would be okay. If I had a problem, the reaction was like this seizing tension from my mom in particular. And I interpreted that, I've only learned again recently, as I'm not trustworthy. Like I can't rely on me because she's reflecting to me that I can't rely on me because there's this grasping, grabbing terror that it's going to, I'll die.
It's the or else.
Yeah.
He can't make this decision or else.
And so I find myself and I have sought, like I would do a video to 99%. And it was my co-founder for a while. It's my brother sometimes. But then go, I don't think this is good. Can you check it? You know, it's like, I'll do all of the stuff that needs to be done. Just pour over it. But I need a co-signer for it to be okay. And I'm learning like, oh, wow. That is a total lack of self-trust. Like to do it, to get it there. And then to need someone else to say, this is good. This is okay. This is acceptable. Is I can't find if it's safe and good and acceptable in and of myself. So that's something that I've been working on has been a business limitation.
It's really tough. And I mean, like this doesn't always happen in just parental relationships. It can happen in like high school relationships. It can happen in like early 20s relationships. But if somebody can sow enough doubt in you to trust yourself, then you must trust them. Mm. And now it makes them invaluable. Mm. And sometimes almost all of the times that somebody does that, it's not even malicious. They just want to be needed so bad.
Yeah.
And you're so susceptible to needing them. And then if they can just drive it a little bit deeper, they can secure their spot and they justify it because they think like, well, this is good for them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is what's best for them. Like, they need me, you know?
How do you see, do you have any examples? I can think of some personally, I don't mean to put you on the spot, in your life or in true crime stories of how the things to look out for that might be people sowing seeds of don't trust yourself versus because there's also this like feedback that friends give each other. If I don't think that you're seeing like what, how do you distinguish between the two?
I've got one. Cause I actually recently was dealing with this. I met somebody who turned out to be a huge manipulator. And what's interesting is this person was so dangerous. I didn't even take the hook. I was like, I don't want to play football on this field.
Okay.
This was
too much for you.
Yeah. But so some of the early signs they gave, and I mean, these are the very delicate ones before it led to like, you just got to trust me. Like over, I'll tell you about this later, but over here,
yeah.
It was fucking wild. But the early signs were I met this person for the very first time. And when I left, they said, I love you. And I thought that this was weird. Huh. And it kind of, made me think, oh, am I like not a girl's girl? Like, is this what girls do? We say, I love you the first time. But I also thought, but I don't love you and I don't know you.
I felt that many points in my life.
At Tanger Outlets, find all the best brands all on sale every day. Step into the season's newest arrivals and save big on the styles you love. Shop Under Armour, Michael Kors, Crocs, and more. With up to 70% off, plus an extra 25% off for a limited time. Hurry in for amazing deals from the brands you love. Only at Tanger Outlets.
Life by right. The people that wound up being some of the ones that hurt me the most were the ones that I felt guilty for not loving them back because they seemed to love me and they said it.
Yeah. And that is self-doubt right there. You were like, well, wait, do I love them? But you know, straight up, I know for certain, I do not love this girl that I just met this day. Mm-hmm. But the fact that I'm thinking, I'm questioning myself as a woman or I'm questioning myself as a friend, you know, because of that.
Yeah.
So I meet them the second time and I love you. Love you so much. Mm-hmm. And I still didn't say it back.
And there's a bait there. I've heard this one. It's baiting the I love you too.
Yeah. Exactly. And like, you know, when we got to this point, I started to wonder, okay, one, is this woman somebody that just has been taught for some reason not to value her love and she gives it away so freely that she's just hoping for some back? That's like the really vulnerable one. Mm-hmm. Or is this somebody that is looking for people that are so vulnerable that they need to be told I love you because they're in such a low spot? Somebody offering that is like, okay, I'll take that because I need it right now, you know? So then the third time we hung out, and mind you, a lot of other things happened, but these are just my little red flag quotes, she said, something else happened and I was like, oh, okay, you know, I won't see you for like a week or two. And she said to me, oh my God, don't worry. We're lifetime, babe. And I was like, I have met you 3 times. Mm-hmm. And that was like one of my like final with the other surrounding things that I was like, you don't mean this. You want to see if I'll take the bait
because
that will show you that I'm vulnerable right now and that I need this love right now. Mm-hmm. So that type of behavior, it may seem really mild, but it is very disturbing to me. And some people may think of it so innocently, but just to be frank, you can't do that. You cannot tell people that you met the first time ever, I love you so much, like for yourself and for their comfort as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if I had to give a caveat, I'd be like, if you're the Dalai Lama and you've done all your enlightenment work and you say it without any bait for them to give it back. And no expectation. Now the self-trust thing is you'll feel that. When you sit down with an enlightened master and they look you in the eye and they express love for you, you will feel that they're not seeking anything from you.
I agree with
that. But when you get that discomfort, you're like, oh, am I a bad friend? There's something wrong with me that I'm not saying it. That's the self-trust bit.
Yeah. Is
that,
if an I love you feels like there should be a call and response then that's weird. But if it feels like, because I have had times where I've told people first, like a friend or a person, like, oh my God, I love you. Hey, you don't have to say anything. I love you so much. I just want you to know that. And when you're ready, like, or if you're not, I don't care, but I have to express this to you.
It's a statement of fact rather than a social tool.
Yeah. Yes. 100%. Yeah. And like, I'm glad that you get that because see how deep that is, but it seems like just such a small gesture of
What I'm learning about sadness, anger, and love is that if you're having an emotion at somebody, you're doing it in order to.
Yes.
I am sad so that you. I am angry so that you. I love so that you. And there's a way to express all of those emotions that just is a fact. Like that my love is a fact. My anger is a fact, but my sadness is a fact. But if there's a subtlety to this, all of those can be expressed in a way that says, and you don't have to do anything about it. I am sharing my experience with you and I'm not asking you to change. And you can feel that when somebody who is really clean with their emotional expression does that. I'm learning increasingly to do that.
Totally. What traits are red flags to you that are like that?
Also,
can I just say this conversation is actually so juicy. Like if anyone's like us or was raised like us, like we're fucking like this is pertinent
learning,
information.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. This was a big one. None of this needs to be nefarious or ill-intended, but it will turn out badly, is people who either position themselves or allow you to position them as middlemen for your contact to others. It's the person that always, when you're like, hey, we should do something together, like, oh, let me contact him. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Oh, let me do that for you. So I had this position in the business that was, and I positioned this person there. It was like, you're going to be the hub of, you know, the employees talk to you, I've had this in various areas of my life. That switchboard place where you're controlling inbound and outbound communication is a place of extreme power and leverage, because all you have to do is change the tone of a communication or say, you know, he did say that. You have, that is like letting someone else be your eyes and ears.
Yes.
And it is unhealthy. So someone who wants to be the mediator, who wants to be the mediator between you and someone else, is just not a healthy way. It doesn't mean that they're evil, doesn't mean that they're bad. If you hear and feel management of how you communicate with other people, meaning like beyond, hey, here's something in confidence, please don't tell them that. But it's like, I don't want to give too many concrete examples here, but if you feel like your relationships with a third party are mediated through something, be very, very wary. That is not healthy.
I know exactly what you mean. And also, I just have to say, like, I know that we don't mean people that see two friends having a conflict and they're like, oh, I want to mediate this.
Yeah.
That's like, the person, I know exactly what you mean. The person we're like, you're about to make, maybe it's a business move or you're going to communicate with somebody, something
I'll reach
very
out
important.
To them.
Yeah. And the person says, wait, let me do it. And it makes you feel like they have something they want to add.
Yeah.
On.
They're being,
No, their ulterior motive to me is they have something they want to add on, or they want to control.
They
want to
be in the
narrative.
Middle. They want to tax the transaction. They want to so this would happen in business where I'm about to build something and it's like, oh yeah, let me set that up. And now it's like, now there's an extra partner in the conversation than people who have to deeply contribute to the project because somebody is organizing it, right? And I felt that a lot of places. In terms of things, what's the question? Things that...
Red flags that you notice that somebody's going to fuck you over later. That's a Charisma on Command video.
Yeah. Well, it's not even fuck you over. It's just it's not going to go well, because none of these, in my case, necessarily imply malintent. I thought this was a kindness. There were people in my life, one of whom wound up stealing a tremendous amount of money, that I thought his ethical infractions were like cute and sweet and like, oh, he's such a little boy about it. Like, you can't get mad at him. There's this childlike quality to the mistakes that would be made in terms of, oh, he didn't tell the truth there, but it's because he's a baby. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, he did that thing. Well, what do you expect? He's a baby. Like,
oh,
there was
God.
This very, this, yeah, he had a quality that was of a little boy. And it was, as I learned more about some of the history, it was like, oh, this is the little boy who is not my fault. Sort of energy.
Oh my God. I hate them motherfuckers. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Well, I would feel that things that I might've been mad for an adult doing who knew better, I wouldn't get mad at him. It's like, cause he doesn't know any better. And so if you find yourself doing that person doesn't know any better. That was a huge learning for me. And it's not that, oh, I need to teach him or do anything. It's just like, this is not going to go well because I'm treating this person who is an adult like a child.
Would you ever describe yourself as gullible?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I think I'm gullible too. Mm. But I was asking you that because I think I'm gullible. Like sometimes I can see, and I actually don't know what the differentiator is. Sometimes I can see through something so quickly and then sometimes it doesn't hit me till it hits me.
Yeah.
You know, and that's 75% of the time.
Sure.
I don't know why this is. Okay. I'm thinking a bit about these traits you're telling me, like you're saying about the guy that's like, I'm just a baby. Or like, sometimes you felt like you couldn't be mad at mom. I feel like I had a similar thing too, where like, how do I explain this? I had a family member that was essentially the only family member left during a period of my life. My family had a lot of issues and this was just the last person that I had, you know? And this guardian was very sick, like very, very mentally ill. And obviously I don't know this as a child, but looking back on that, I realized that I made a lot of excuses for that person all the time, every step of the way. Some of the most disturbing shit, I made an excuse for it. And I couldn't figure out why, but I think I realized that when I was 12 or 13, I realized there was nothing I could do. This was my situation. So I had to create a reality that I could exist in where this person wasn't awful. Because I accepted that this person was awful, then I was in an awful situation. Mm-hmm. But if I could change the lens and say, oh, it's not that bad, so that I could survive,
And thrive and be in a wonderful situation with someone who does love you and is taking good care of you.
Yeah, and yeah. It's like, I just need to pretend until I figure it out and get out of this. But that has turned into, as an adult, me tending to make excuses for people with bad behavior because I haven't figured out how to escape it or get away from it. So I'm like, okay, I just need to survive with it for a while by fawning to it.
Yeah.
And then I'll figure it out. And then sometimes, you know, I don't know. I'm a real 17 strikes and you're out type of girl. So like sometimes they don't even have to buy themselves more time. I'll buy them time and then I'll forgive them afterwards.
Well, you're right. It's a survival strategy, which is tied to, if I lose this relationship, this person, this quality of interaction that I've been familiar with since I was literally dependent on other people, if that leaves my life, I'll die.
Yes.
And so I want to find a way to keep it in my life. And I think that's why some of these hooks keep running until you do the work to catch that child consciousness that still exists in you up to the reality of your adult situation, which is, oh, I can live without this. I can do better without this.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but that is not a cognitive experience. That is an emotional, felt, slow, integrative experience that can't just be, this is when I see friends date the same kind of woman that just goes terribly every time, or get in the same kind of horrible business partnership with someone that is, you know, like, it can be frustrating because you're like, I can give you the sentence that is going to get you out of this. This is codependency. This is your attraction to narcissism, whatever. But it doesn't. That's not how it's learned.
You could explain it to them. And I mean, here's
and someone
thing.
Could explain to me.
Well, we're explaining our own fucking problems right now. And we're like, well, let's go bang our head up against the wall after this, you know?
Yeah.
But what were we talking about?
No, just that it is not a cognitive process of, and you said, I don't know why some of these things and why not, but you just described this. It's the childhood thing. It's the lies that were required to survive are the ones that you need to continue perpetuating until you can slowly work your way through them as an adult.
Yeah. And also I like what you said a little bit ago about it's not just an instant process. I think it takes time because, you know, going back to my football player analogy that I like to play on the weird field, I'm like, yeah, let's play this game again. I've been that football player, quote unquote, for 15 years. And only in the past, I would say 2 or 3 years, have I started to have some major healing. And so for lack of a better term, I've been the football player for 15 years, but I've only been a little more healed for 2 or 3 years.
What was the switch?
I needed to go to therapy. And you know what?
It was therapy. Okay.
Yeah. Honestly, it was having a very good therapist
that
gave me like EMDR and like really, just really went in. It was my therapist that changed everything for me.
Yeah.
But so I've only been a little more healed working on it for 3 years. I would say more healed for the past year and a half. And boy, let me tell you, I love sitting at home by myself, not causing no trouble. I like to watch White Lotus. I make chocolates at home. I make my little music. I have a perfume lab. I like just mind my fucking business and I love it. But sometimes I love the game, Charlie.
Yeah.
You know, I got it. And so because I've existed in this space for longer, I probably, even though it's not good for me, I probably feel my most self, the most, you know, when I'm playing this game.
Yeah.
So you might feel the most yourself when you're fawning or something.
Or a drunk feels most themselves in the bar and a workaholic feels most themselves when the deal isn't getting done and they're ignoring their family. Mm-hmm. And it's the allure of the addictive cycle of
who you think you are too.
Yeah. Which... And what I have seen, and I've said it.
Also, we're so fucking annoying because like who has conversations like this?
Oh, no, this is, the biggest problems in my life are how I relate to my own experience, right? And it's not that any of the problems are so difficult to solve. Like we're talking about, if somebody else took over your body, they could extricate themselves from every toxic relationship that you're in that is so appealing to you, you know? And somebody could do the same with me if they're like, you know, the patterns that I have with my girlfriend that are unhealthy, they'd be like, well, just don't do that. It'd be easy for someone with a different set of history and traumas to just
They would change our lives so fast. But okay, I got a question.
Yeah.
If somebody switched lives with you, stepped into your body, your brain, your world, whatever, and they, you know, open your front door, what's the first thing that you think that a random person inhabiting your body would notice?
this is a rando. This is like a person from Walmart that is just.
Yeah. Like they become Charlie. What are they?
Probably that I'm in, you know, a high tax bracket and I live in a large house. And that would be a bump for the rando off the street.
Wow. That's like, so I was going to say they would notice the screaming first. Like if anyone inhabited my body, it, like there would be like eight different voices that are like, you got it. You're like, you're a piece of shit. Like make some fucking coffee, do this, whatever. And then just perpetual screaming. Mm-hmm. I honestly, to me, I feel like there's a hurricane that exists in my head, like at all times. And anybody else that like stepped into the space, they'd be like, what the fuck is this? But I'm like, I live here.
Yeah.
Like,
do you think, so we talked about histrionic a little. What traits do you see in the creator economy that are different? So one thing that I've noticed is I've worked as a consultant. I knew a bunch of people in finance. My mom was a nurse. My girlfriend is in animal rescue. Every profession has a particular style of personality and also of toxicity that exists.
You are 100% correct.
So like the animal people, for instance, that are like, they're some of the most caring, compassionate people. And also they have real issues with humans. They're like, oh my God, this beautiful little bunny needs help. And they're
kill
like,
all men.
And then they hate people. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, I get it. There's the soft, furry creature that is
And they
is
feel
safer.
Like wildly misunderstood.
They feel
by
wildly
people,
misunderstood. Like, yes. So there's, and I could do the finance, I could do all of these.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, and I've seen some of the creators, but you know more creators than I do.
I don't. I've been in like creator circles. Like I've been in a couple different groups and things.
Attention seeking seems like an obvious.
Oh, that's a really high one. Okay. All right. Okay. Sorry. I will throw out the histrionic, not diagnosis, but I'm like, there are traits that match up with, okay. Have you heard of that guy, Johnny Somali?
Heard of.
Yeah. And have you ever wondered why he goes to Japan and starts messing with people and doing fucked up stuff and recording it? That is textbook histrionic traits. Mm-hmm. It is attention seeking outside of the realm that we can barely like even understand. Ooh, I'm going to say this one too, because actually a therapist a friend of mine, she's the one that clocked this. Nikocado Avocados shows some very, very histrionic personality traits. Not saying any, you know, diagnoses or anything. I'm not a therapist. But like, these are some like YouTube personalities.
If you don't
that
know,
you
Nikocado Avocado
see.
Was a creator who then got exorbitantly fat doing mukbangs and like deadly overweight.
Yes.
Disappeared for a while.
Like he was wearing the mask, like the oxygen mask. Yeah. Like
it was just extreme. And then disappeared for a while and showed up way at a way lower weight. Almost is just like a shocking return. And I have no idea what he's up to now.
Yeah, but I mean all of his content across the board, just the screaming, the attention seeking, the saying insane stuff. And one particular trait about histrionics that I think is so interesting is their attention seeking will follow kind of normal patterns in line with what you expect of them and what also most attention seekers will do. But histrionics do this really unique thing where when their attention isn't working, they will go completely off the map and do something really bizarre. Huh. Something that you can't even wrap your head around. And that's part of the
shock value to bring your attention back. Yeah.
A lot of people that do shock value stuff, it's their histrionic traits. Mm. And I don't mind talking about that disorder too much because I don't like to talk about like, you know, schizophrenia or like bipolar, borderline, anything. I feel like a lot of those get misconstrued. Even narcissistic personality disorder, okay? Even the fucking sociopaths. They're always taking L's because I feel like those...
They're always taking L's.
They're taking L's. I feel like a lot of those personality disorders are very pop culture-y and they get, you know, really scrutinized. But nobody talks about histrionics and they're everywhere because they're annoying but harmless. Mm. Whereas a lot of other personality disorders can really... throw you for a loop, you know?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I know that you specialized in is women who fall in love with serial killers.
Hybristophiliacs.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Hybristophiliacs. Let's see. Okay. I have to say, full disclaimer, if you're a Luigi Mangione fan, I don't put them in the hybristophiliac category because I don't even put his whole thing in the true crime category. I think it's more of a social issue. So I just want to say the Luigi fangirls, you're not included in this. What I'm talking about are people, for example, that think Wade Wilson is really hot. Wade Wilson is just a career criminal that has a couple face tattoos and a haircut that girls like. And he murdered two women, one of which he ran over with a car. And he said that he ran over her over and over and over again until her guts were all over the sidewalk. That's what he said about this woman. And there are hundreds of women that are writing to him in jail, creating Facebook pages. They're orchestrating his social media campaigns. He tells them on the phone how to turn the music down in videos, how to edit it. Don't use that picture of me. And these women on the Facebook group, they go and edit these videos and post them on TikTok from the criminal's direction in jail. That's how obsessed they are. They're all fighting with each other, donating money to him. I think, you know, Wade Wilson probably had like, he had over $150,000 donated to his commissary from women that were fans. And
is this a singular Wade Wilson experience, or is this like,
oh, this is huge. Are you kidding me? A hybristophilia is incredibly common. There were hundreds of women that wrote to Charles Manson, Ted Bundy, Richard Ramirez, who had stinky breath, by the way, Chris Watts, a man that murdered his wife.
I know the Chris Watts one. Yeah.
Yes. His really? Two children. Yes. And also Chris Watts, his two girls were not dead. He put them in the seat in the back seat of the car with his dead wife, Shanann, in the back, like, and then he took them to this oil vat threw his daughters in there alive because he couldn't bear to suffocate them again. He threw them into the oil vat alive. And there are women that write to him and they say, Chris, I don't think you did it.
No.
Chris, I love you. Chris, you know, if you just need a friend.
But wait. So what is the psychology of this? Is it the, I don't think you did it?
So they don't care if he did it. They haven't even assessed whether he did it or not. In fact, I think a lot of them do think that he did it, because what I believe that they're looking for is, I believe that a lot of them are women that either feel like they're nobodies or they feel like they're not safe. And they think that if they can attach themselves to this violent, popular man, then they can be somebody and they'll be protected. I've also started, and that's where my initials come in. Like, that kind of clocks or makes sense, mm-hmm. right? And then the other things that I realized too, and this came in later when I was looking at this hybristophiliac named Ash Trevino, is that actually a lot of these women are also so insecure that they prefer a man that's in jail. Because they think, oh, you can't go and hook up with other women because you're in jail. But then what happens is they might be up for release or they might be getting out soon. And she doesn't want him to leave the jail. And I couldn't figure out why until I put this piece together. Or another thing that will happen is they'll start accusing their inmate husband of like, you're sleeping with other guys, you're fucking other dudes. And it's like, they thought that they were going to be able to handle it because there's no other women in the jail, but then they become so obsessed and insecure.
The idea of someone in a cage is so appealing to them.
Yes.
Interesting.
And also it's that they own this dangerous animal that's got all these, like, you know, names that like this makes them somebody. There was a hybristophiliac that testified for Sarah Boone. Sarah Boone was a woman who was abusing her boyfriend for over a year and a half. She took his cell phone. She wouldn't let him have a job. He was Hispanic. His name was Jorge. She would call him George as a way to demean him. This woman was a horrible alcoholic, horribly abusive. She ends up murdering Jorge by telling him to get into the suitcase, and she zipped it up and she left him in the suitcase.
Wow.
Yeah. And actually, the way that Jorge died was not just from losing oxygen in the suitcase. It was because the suitcase was flat on the ground and he died from a positional asphyxiation.
These are so wild.
Oh yeah, God. Dude. So, here's.
I do not know how people watch this stuff regularly.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, why would somebody do that, Charlie? Right? I got to know why. Okay. But just to give you a sense of justice at all, the reason that Sarah Boone got caught, she denied it to all hell. She even called the police and were like, my boyfriend, he went into a suitcase and I think he's dead. She was so drunk that she recorded a video of him begging to be let out of the suitcase while she laughed at him. And it was on her phone and she didn't even realize that it was on her fucking
phone. There's a level of both, like, disconnection empathetically and also idiocy that is so...
Justification too.
Yeah.
And you know what is interesting? I think we lack that trait. I think we lack that justification trait for ourselves. We tend to justify and make excuses for other people. I'm seeing that as a pattern that we both have. But how often do you justify that something that happened to you was bad, or something that you did was good, or something that you did had to be done? I justify for other people much more than myself.
Hmm.
But these types of people, they tend to justify their actions no matter how bad they are. And they yeah. really will reinforce it. But anyways, so this woman is horrible, right? She had a high burst of filiac that this was crazy. Testified for her in court.
It's a woman in this yeah. case? This mm-hmm. is okay, so this is now a lesbian relationship.
Yeah. Well, or maybe they, or she claimed they were friends, but okay. it, you know, something okay. was going on. So Sarah Boone, the killer, the suitcase killer, she tells this hybristophiliac that's writing to her that wants to be friends with her. The hybristophiliac is very sick. She has some type of cancer and needs a transplant. And Sarah goes, oh my God, I would totally give you that organ. Anyways, how's your day? And that's how she bonded with this woman that ended up testifying for her later, trying to say that like Sarah was such a great person.
Wow.
But it does something for them. This person that was, you know, very sick, had cancer, is just, you know, alone because she described her life was like that. Well, now she's attached to this famous murderer. And now she's testifying in this famous case.
Important.
And yeah. now she's saving her. So her life has gone from this mm-hmm. to this.
There's not men really who do this though, I imagine.
There are not as many there are not a lot of hybristophiliac men. No, some
interesting.
Some that went after like Jodi Arias, but they were a little more
just attracted to her or something.
Probably thought she was hot.
Yeah, I don't know that the dangerous is the thing. It's just willing to overlook.
Well, some guys like crazy girls too. Mm-hmm. They just like it's like a thing for them. Like if a dude's mom was fucking crazy, like they'll like crazy girls. It's just that. And that's their hook and they can't unhook from it.
Hmm. So what you're doing all of it. Is this like a specialty of yours, the hybristophiliac?
I'm just fascinated by it. Just really fascinated by it. Cause they do so much weird shit. I'm like, are you guys okay?
Got it. What do you get out of it? Like when you unlock something in the hybristophiliac understanding?
You know, I'm if I'm just being like honest, I think that there is a little bit of ego in pulling apart the hybristophiliac part for me and others. I think people never do anything for one reason. I think it's for a multitude of reasons. So what do I get out of it? See, bro, also, if you ask me shit, I'm gonna answer transparently to my own detriment, okay? but what do I get out of it? I get one, understanding, because that one is just fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. And then two, I probably get a little ego out of it of like, oh, I would never do that, or I don't have that trait. And then probably I feel like there's something else in the mix, but I can't quite put my finger on what it is.
Yeah.
Definitely those two.
Yeah. I we've talked about this a little bit, but it's always interesting to reflect on what are the particular issues and psychological things that hook me. And it's not necessarily ones that I'm doing. Like I said, Brian Laundrie grabbed me, but it's not because I'm going
to
murder my
girlfriend.
You
should pay somebody to trick you.
I should pay someone to trick me.
Yeah.
Why?
Like just pay somebody like, hey, sometime in the next 3 years.
I don't need to pay people. People trick me just fine.
No, but like I think it's time to run a psychological experiment on yourself, Charlie. Take it to the next level. Just hire somebody that like at some point randomly in 3 years, they're going to come into your life with a certain plot line that you cannot resist.
Okay.
And throughout the whole way, they're going to analyze all of your behavior and try to trick you and lead you astray. But at the end, they're going to be like, Charlie, this was a social experiment.
You're free. Yeah. I'm not gonna...
And here's the report.
Yeah.
You would eat that shit up, bro.
I like to think that I would not be as susceptible as I've been in the past.
I would like to think that too, but sometimes I want to eat a little catnip.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, beautiful. Is there anything else that we should chat about?
No.
Okay.
Okay. I didn't know how long your podcast was. I didn't know if you were about to Joe Rogan me or something. I was
okay. No, you don't need to drink coffee. Where can people find you?
I am Bose versus the World on YouTube. I do a lot of videos on like sometimes pop culture stuff, a lot of like manipulation shit. And honestly, half of my videos are just me being triggered and like overly hypervigilant. But I do it for content. So if you like that, you can watch that. I also have body cams. I have a channel called Best of Body Cams with Bose. And you can watch Sinister on Fridays where we break down people's horrible psychological patterns.
Are you doing anything with you have anything in production that you're working on right now for?
Yeah, like, but I cannot talk about that right now, but I have some cool stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, I have some very cool stuff.
Not for camera. All right. Well, thank you guys. We appreciate you all. Catch you next time. Peace.